Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can also email me, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. And you can check us out on Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, iTunes, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. I want to say thank you so much for tuning into the show. I hope you have enjoyed the episodes. I hope you shared them with other people. If for some reason you're listening to an episode and you have to leave or go and do something, all the episodes are archived on all those different platforms, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. Well, this morning I am speaking with a young writer of speculative fiction. The book is called The Year of the Witching, and her name is Alexis Henderson. Good morning, Alexis.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. I didn't know. I didn't do an offering this morning. Should I get my crystal and, like, prick my finger so that we have a good interview? What should I do this morning?
No offerings necessary. I feel like the good vibes and good juju are already flowing, so I think we're good.
Okay, good, good, good. So this book, tell the audience a little bit about it.
So The Year of the Witching is a dark fantasy / horror novel, and it follows a young girl named Emmanuel who grows up in a puritanical theocracy, and it's led by this sort of domineering prophet. And one day, Emmanuel wanders into the forbidden forest that surrounds her commune home, and there she encounters the spirits of four witches, and through them she uncovers dark secrets about her past, her dead mother, and the religion that she's grown up in. So it's kind of gothic and a little bit gory at times. And it grapples with a lot of things like feminism and religious persecution and abuse, and cults and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of blood going on in here. You got a lot of sacrifice. That's why I brought it up in the beginning. Like, actually, both sides are sacrificing. And it's funny. It's like sometimes people are in this bubble, and it's like you're doing exactly what the other side is doing as well. Did you do that purposely? Like the prophet is sacrificing the lamb, and then Emmanuel, she doesn't sacrifice a person, but she does cut herself. So there's somebody else that does make a sacrifice. I don't want to bring that up because that would kind of ruin the story for people. Did you purposely have both sides dealing with this blood situation thing going on, and also menstrual cycles as well?
Yes. Yeah. So that was definitely intentional. I wanted a magic system that had a cost. And to me, a blood sacrifice just made sense. And so I had this sort of idea where people were trying to reach some type of power, and they have different pathways to that power and different approaches. But the blood sacrifice is what is required to access some sort of like supernatural power. So it is kind of like two sides of the same coin, or parallel pathways to accessing power that maybe one could argue is the same or has the same origin place. The Dark Mother and the Father, they kind of have to, those are the two gods in my book, essentially. They kind of both are required to exist in order to, for the other to exist. So it's intrinsically connected. That was something that was fascinating to me, because they're both opposites and yet sort of the same.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I was like brought it up, because I'm like, you're doing blood stuff, they're doing blood stuff. What's the difference? And like, why is yours not witchcraft, but theirs is witchcraft? Another thing you talk about is the male is light and the female is dark. And even the space that they inhabit, if you will, the male is, they have the fields, it's kind of open, and then there's this dark wood. I found that as I was reading that, I was getting a little angry, I have to say. I was like, not at you, but at the world you were creating, you know. Did you see that in other writings? Did you decide to make the light dark? How did that come about?
So I think that like light and darkness is like such a common trope, especially in fantasy and horror, right? And I was interested in kind of examining that myself. But I had a lot of like reservations. So primarily one of them that I've always thought was a little bit kind of colorist and borderline racist was this idea that everything white is good and everything that's dark is bad. And
yeah,
since
I was kind of
so it was something that I was kind of bothered by. And like even in our world, when you know, people say like, they parallel everything evil with darkness. And I was so troubled by that. And so in this book told from the perspective of, you know, a mixed race, but, you know, a girl who is, you know, for all intents and purposes, black, is how she presents to the world. I am wondering what the repercussions of growing up in a society that demonizes everything dark would be for her. And then along with that, there's also the society is strictly patriarchal, and because of that, they favor men. And there's this this idea that women are manipulative and evil and dark, you know, another negative in this culture. They parallel everything that they don't like with darkness. And so it kind of creates this double whammy for my main character because she's both black and a woman. So she's like kind of the lowest rung
mm-hmm.
of society. And that was definitely something I wanted to examine, someone kind of realizing the sickness of this really binary, polarizing belief system where everything that is other is inherently evil.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Actually, you know, not that long. So I wrote it over my last semester of my senior year in college. The first act of the book, roughly the first act of the book, was actually my senior thesis that I graduated with from the University of South Carolina at Beaufort. I wrote it in like 4 or 5 months, just shot. Three or four months. Yeah.
Wow. So how long have you been writing in general? Like when you first started writing, do you remember the story? Do you have the story still? Do you have like the book or journal that you were using?
Yeah, I'm actually looking at them right now. I'm in the process of organizing my book. So they're actually sitting in front of me, this like stack of journals where I wrote down early ideas. I remember the place where I wrote the first sentences of the Year of the Witching, and they never really changed that much. I was sitting in the tutoring center at my college because I was a writing tutor, and I didn't have a student for that like half hour or quarter. And I just sat there and kind of started writing. I keep journals, but it really is kind of like it's kind of just like I'm rushing through the process. So it's like whatever's around me, whether that's a napkin or the back of a receipt or oftentimes my notes app on my phone. It's like one of my favorite places to write. I just type everything into my notes app. And then I come home if I'm out, like when I was at school, I would come home from a day of classes and I would have to like transcribe all of these random notes that I wrote like in the margins of my college notes or whatever it would be. And I would transcribe it all into a Word document.
Now, this is interesting. You're a young writer, and just what you described about even the process of you, where you write is interesting. And you said, I write them in the notes of my phone. And I've had so many writers on different ages, but I will say, like, the older writers, when they maybe first started writing, they were still writing in books and using pens and paper.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that you just now said, oh, I write them in the notes of my phone. So how has technology helped you with your writing in terms of maybe research, in terms of even the cover of the book? Let's talk about that. How did you come up with the cover? Who illustrated that?
When it comes to technology, it's hugely helpful to me. And actually, I can tie this to the cover of my book because I'm a big fan of kind of like going online when I do my research and finding images that correspond with what I see in my head. So when it came time to create the cover of the book, my editor was like, do you have any ideas? And I was able to link to this like massive Pinterest board full of like years worth of pictures that I had assembled just by researching for my book. And I never thought this would come in handy. I never thought I would share it with anyone. But I think that it's like, I wonder sometimes if technology has allowed me to expedite the process of creation in that like I'm able to sort of more rapidly develop ideas because of all of the materials I have access to, pictures and images, and I can Google anything that I want and kind of tour the world through the internet. And so it's immensely helpful. It's amazing.
I read somewhere that you bought a book that was 1,000 pages long and it had 5,000 spells in it. Have you tried any of the spells and what happened?
I most certainly have. Yes, I have. It was a really handy book. I originally just bought it strictly for research for the Year of the Witching. The magic system in the Year of the Witching wasn't directly inspired by any real world practice. However, I was interested in the ways that people practice magic in our world, just since I was building my own magic system from scratch. So I researched and then, I kind of started to dabble a little bit myself and practice a little bit myself. And I used, like, I think mostly, like, really, I don't want to say mild spells. No spells like mild, but, like, cleansing spells and spells like that. Moved into a new apartment and, you know, I did the ritual with sage and I think burning rosemary even. To just make sure, again, I want good vibes, good juju, good vibes.
Definitely. I can understand. You don't want anybody's old S-H-I-T left in there. Go away. You talked about this witchcraft, and I want to say, you know, witchcraft in the real world is happening, but also in a negative way. I'm not sure if you're familiar, like in Uganda, they're sacrificing children, like today,
yes,
in this day and age, because they believe the negative aspect of witchcraft, like they think witchcraft is bad, and they're using children as sacrifice. Had you read about that before your writing? Did you know about that information?
Yeah, pretty extensively. I researched a few years before I started writing The Year of the Witching. I was working on this short story, and it was actually about that. It was about a child. She's albino, and she was sacrificed, or someone was coming after her to sacrifice or use her body parts for witchcraft in Tanzania. So I was researching that. When I found out about that, it was long before I had even an inkling to write The Year of the Witching, but I was, like, horrified that this was, like, yeah, a thing. I do think that, like, in The Year of the Witching, I was kind of more focused on witchcraft being the religion that is more persecuted against. So it's kind of a different way of looking at it. But I think that both instances are a real testament to the fact that, you know, religion can be used as a tool to express violence and the horror of that, which is certainly kind of at the heart of my book.
We were talking about parallels earlier, and I thought about, this is a sensitive area. People think about, like, Israel and Palestine, but that's an ongoing battle. And they have a lot of similarities in both the cultures that's parallel. And it's just so interesting how people want to point fingers, but it's like, if you stop, these realize that we're actually doing the same thing. You come up with some witch names, and one of them is Lilith. And I was reading about Lilith. She was actually the first wife of Jesus. Is that correct? What else did you find out about Lilith in your research?
Well, I had actually heard that she was allegedly the first wife of Adam.
Adam.
Eve.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Adam.
And that she was deemed not a good wife, and so Eve was the next runner up, I guess, and kind of took her place. I did some research. I was fascinated by the myths about Lilith being, like, mother of monsters. But to be honest, I'd heard vague things in passing about Lilith, and then when I was looking for names for the book, without kind of consciously thinking about the myths that I had heard of in the past, I just, like, was like, oh, Lilith seems fitting for this character. And it was only afterward, when I kind of revisited the myths about Lilith, that I was like, oh, this is quite, it's quite interesting that I settled on that name, because, yeah, she is the mother of monsters and is kind of known to have brought in these dark creatures or entities into the world. And I think that, you know, in my book, Lilith is sort of the mother of the plagues in that way. She's kind of bringing this power into the world, in a sense. That was really cool.
And you have some other witches as well.
Some
other witches as well. Tell us about those other witches, Delilah and Lael, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. But
Delilah,
tell them
Jael,
about the other witches.
Yeah. There's a pair, they're lovers. I just call them the lovers. Honestly, half the time I forget their separate names, because to me they're kind of like this united entity. The lovers in my head. And I was fascinated with them. I was fascinated with this kind of like carnal energy that exuded from them. That there's a scene where Emmanuel comes upon them and they're having this kind of like romantic moment, let's say, in the woods. They're entangled with each other. And it was one of my favorite scenes to write in the book. So I think the lovers to me represented this kind of like feminine, like sexuality kind of being expressed. And then there's Delilah. To me, she's more of the tragic figure. I kind of always think of her as almost like the little one of the witches, like the almost like the one that needs protecting in a way, or maybe that's just how I feel about her. And she's
yeah,
an entity that occupies.
And,
yeah, I don't know. I've never talked about this, but I've always felt that way about her. Like, she's the little one, like the ones that all the other witches would probably try to protect in a way. There's like a childlike almost innocence about her that I think makes her tragic and sympathetic.
Because, you know, like Delilah was like in the Old Testament or something, and she stole, she found out about Samson's hair and his power. So in that sense, she was... I guess larger than life or something, but either way, the book actually shows for me, there are instances where the man is manipulating the woman. And actually I think overall, because of the, if you want to call it a cult society, the society at Bethel, the man is at the head and he's actually manipulating everybody and their thoughts and telling them stories about like what's beyond the borders and things of that nature. But it's not true. But they're saying it's the women that are bad. So isn't that crazy?
Right.
You know, in real life, we see things happening where, you know, a woman say gets assaulted and then it's her fault, you know, because of what she was wearing, what time of the night she was out, who she was with. All these things are questioned, and then the guy is like, oh, I don't know anything. She said yes. Well, she invited me into the room, and, you know, like, hello, what? You don't have any control?
I don't know what your thoughts are. Yeah, I was definitely interested in kind of looking at that, because I do think that people point fingers, and I think there's this connotation that women are cunning and manipulative and seductive, right? But men do a lot of manipulating too. It's just a different kind of, not even just a different form. Men manipulate, people manipulate, and there is no like gender binary where like one, you know, party is manipulative and cunning and seductive and the other isn't. I think it's just like people attain power through underhanded ways, and in the Year of the Witching, I was really kind of more focused on the ways that the men in the society were doing that, because most of the witches were kind of honest. They weren't right, but they were honest. They weren't trying to make the plague seem like a good thing. They just kind of expressed their anger as it was, and they weren't, I didn't feel, trying to necessarily manipulate Emmanuel. They were trying to show her the truth.
Yeah, there's a lot of generational things going on in terms of trauma and the way you're supposed to be because you came from this certain family. In your life, are there things that your parents or your family thought you should be but you didn't agree with and you went a different way?
So my parents now today, they're very, very accepting of me, which I'm fortunate to have that. I think that in some ways my parents and I, we grew up alongside each other. You know, you hit this age, normally it's in like teenage years where you realize your parents are just humans and that they're still growing up. And I, that kind of was a direct inspiration for the Year of the Witching, right? Because Emmanuel is kind of the same age as her mother when her mother dies, when this book begins. So she's kind of seeing her mother not as a mother, but as like a peer or a human being flawed, just like she is. And so I can much relate to that kind of experience. It was the same with me and my parents. Like, I don't think any parent-child relationship is perfect, but I do think there is something kind of perfect in this realization where you look at your parents for the first time and realize, oh my God, they're just a human. Like, they're flawed and they're still growing up at like 35 or 40 or 50. And when I'm 45 or 50, I will still be growing up as well.
I think it's hard though for some people to see their parents as human. Some people go through their whole life that the parents are on a pedestal. And there's like a dissonance of, they think you can't really handle accepting the parent as a human, you know, and vice versa. Parents may put their child on the pedestal with their dreams and hopes into the child, thinking the child's going to be this, that, and the other when they're born. and then they go some other way. And the parents have to also accept or not accept that way the child went. You know, I'm a parent, and as a parent, I can understand. I have both situations. You know, there were things that I thought my daughter was going to do, and then she didn't do, and I had to adjust, and then she went a different way. And same with her, she had to learn about me as a human, you know. So I think that goes no matter where you are, in Bethel or in real life. Who are some writers that you look up to, that maybe you would like to talk to one day, or, you know, have some tea or coffee with?
So the one that always comes up to me that I'm in awe of her work is N.K. Jemisin, author of The Fifth Season and the Broken Earth Trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
absolutely a fantastic, I mean, I think she's the best of her generation, and she's, like, to me, one of the best writers alive right now, and her books just move me in such a deep way. So yeah, honestly, if I could even just, like, tell her for that, it would be enough. Another one that I'm a huge fan of that I know. Oh, Anthony Bourdain. I know he's not strictly just a writer, but he does a lot of other things. And I know I obviously won't have the chance to talk to him, unfortunately, because he passed. But he was someone who I think I just looked up to and really admired. I think the writers that I really admire, like, I admire their spirit or some type of, like, tenacity or strength in addition to just their work. And I think that both of them sort of fit that bill for me.
Religion impacted your life? Are you very religious? And if so, what religion are you practicing, if you mind talking about it?
Oh, yeah. So there's not really much to talk about. I'm not religious. I grew up, like, very pretty conservative religious. I was homeschooled and had brief brushes with fundamentalist Christianity. So that was a part of my upbringing for not even for a time, almost my entire, my entire childhood, we were Christian. But I'm not anymore. I just sort of dabble as I see fit in things that make me curious, which is normally, like, witchcraft, occulty stuff. But, I don't even think that my religion has, like, a neat label at this point. I don't think I practice anything. I'm kind of just, like, a religious refugee, let's say that. I just kind of wander and I'm curious
refugee.
About all of it. But I don't actively sort of, have one place where I make my home. I'm fascinated by religion. And
go ahead, sorry.
Oh no, I thought I'd be fascinated by religion, for sure. Always will be.
We were talking earlier about cheesesteaks. What are some of your other favorite foods that you like to eat? What's, like, your junk food that you would go to?
Oh, junk food. Okay, so let me think. What do I really, really, really love sweets. And I don't even want to call it junk food because, to me, like, I love, like, a mochi with, like, red stuff with, like, red bean paste is something that I could just constantly eat. I love popcorn. I love cake, brownies, that sort of thing. So if I'm going to get something kind of junky, it's that. For entrees and stuff like that, I really love Korean food. So, like, a few weeks ago, my partner and I, we made, like, a beef bulgogi with ribeye steak, and it was truly one of the best meals I've had in recent memory. Amazing.
Do you eat kimchi? Do you eat kimchi?
All the time. Yeah, it's always in my
fridge.
All the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember the first time with the kimchi. I was like, what? It's what? Can you tell me? I'm, like, looking at the description on the menu board. I'm like, I don't know about that. But I've eaten so many different types of food as well. And I tried and I was like, oh, okay. Okay. Now I understand. So it's okay to try different things.
For sure. It's so good. Yeah. The heat takes you by surprise at first, but then it's like, it's so delicious. And I just feel like it goes with everything.
Can you bake? You said you like cakes and stuff. Can you bake?
I'm a terrible baker.
You're a terrible baker. So you got to go to the store. What about your partner?
I make my partner do it. My partner do the baking. She's great. She's a good baker. And she likes it. So she makes, like, macarons and stuff like that. And I eat them.
So where do you like to travel now that we're going to be hopefully more open and able to? Where would you like to go?
I have the tickets to two vacations at the moment. One is in Alaska. So we're going to fly into
Alaska.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm very excited. Alaska's on my bucket list. I've always wanted to go to Alaska. It was like a tippy top of my travel list for a long time now. So I want to go to Alaska, and I'm also going to New Orleans, which I think probably equally excited about. I've always wanted to visit New Orleans as well. So we'll be heading down there too, and I'm very excited. New Orleans is a place where I'm just going to eat. Like, that's my main focus. I just want to eat. I was just looking at restaurants today.
Yeah.
So.
Are you going to when it's really hot? Or are you going cold? What time of the year are you going?
I think it's in November, so it shouldn't be cold. It should be an off season, which is good because I'll be able to walk more. Yeah.
Yeah. There won't be so many people around and everything. So what's coming
exactly.
up next for you? What's the next book that you're going to be working on?
So it hasn't been announced yet, so I can't say too much, but it's in the same vein. It's gothic horror, very bloody. I think that, you know, people who are into sort of like Crimson Peaks or Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno Garcia, that kind of spirit is what you can expect from me next. So.
Okay, and are you going to write anything other than fiction at one point? I read an essay you wrote, and you were talking about fear and how fear was a constant companion for you. Is that still the case? Has writing helped you get over the fear or deal with the fear?
Yeah, no, it's definitely still the case. I'm a deeply anxious person. You know, I've gone to therapy, and I've tried to work through it as best as I can, but I think that the fear is intrinsically attached to my curiosity and the things I like to write about. So in that way, I think that writing, I don't want to say has helped, but maybe it has. I think in some ways it's given me an outlet for this kind of inherent fear that I have. And so instead of feeling like I'm victim to it, I feel like I'm using it to kind of create. And that is empowering. It's kind of taught me to make, a friend of my fear. So,
yeah. A lot of people might be dealing with that issue, so I wanted to bring that up, and that way they can have some kind of avenue or option of coping with, you know, fear or anxiety, because that happens to many people, and they may think they're by themselves, you know, dealing with this issue, but they're not, you know. So I just wanted to bring that up. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show this morning, and I can't wait for the next book. I hope you come back, and we can talk about the next book. And tell your partner, like, if she wants to mail anything to me that she's taking, I'm open.
I will definitely tell her. She's always looking for people to test her suite. So, yeah, for sure.
Like,
I'll pass
that
along.
That's what it is. I'm a tester. Exactly. Exactly.
For important
research
role, very
purposes.
Important role. Exactly. Yeah. Very important.
All right. Well, you have a great weekend, and I hope you have a wonderful time in Alaska. I'm so jealous. I can't imagine. Take pictures and post them on your social media. Oh, tell them your social media handles on, like, Twitter and things like that.
Yeah. So you can find me on Twitter at Alex H. Writes, and Instagram, I'm Lexis, L-E-X-I-S-H. And then my website is alexishenderson.com, but there isn't much on there, but, you know.
But still, they can write. They can sign up for the newsletter on there and get updates about the new book. So that would be good,
that's
right?
That's true. True. Very true. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you. And I hope you have a great two trips and a great weekend, okay?
Okay. Thank you so much for having me, Joy. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye. I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I just got off the phone with author Alexis Henderson. We were talking about her book, The Year of the Witching. I'm going to be giving away some copies of her book, so you want to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram. And also on Facebook now, I created a group, so hopefully you'll get more updates. Facebook is just crazy with not allowing everybody on your, you know, page to get updates, but the group, everybody seems to get the updates more frequently. So check that out, and I hope you guys have a great weekend, and I will see you next week.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time, as in spaghetti sandwiches for dinner. They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. visit adoptuskids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.